that this evening. I did not think it would benefit us at all simply looking at the trial of Jesus in a vacuum. I really thought it would be wise and necessary to take a big picture look at how the events came about, some of the persons involved, and what brought everybody to Jerusalem at that day and time. And in looking at that historical perspective, I find that it helps me bring some, it helps me put things in proper perspective in terms of time. For instance, a lot of times when we are studying the Bible, we do look at things in a vacuum, and we don't really have a good understanding about what's going on, for instance, in Rome at the time, what historically has happened to make these events come about. And I think those kind of things will encourage more thought, which is really what preaching is all about. So let's get started. I will start out with that historical perspective. And in order to do that, I think it helps to take a look at really three different issues or things. Number one is the Romans. Number two is the Jews. And then number three is Jesus himself. I just want to give a brief review, if you will, of the history, not necessarily the whole history of Rome, but a short history of Rome to give us a feel for how Rome came about and how they ended up having power over the people of Jerusalem. A lot of this will be old hat to some of the younger students here, and it's all something we've all learned in school at one time or another. But briefly, as far as the city of Rome is concerned, though many people will compare the United States of America currently to historical Rome, I think in truth, there was, before Rome existed, there was never anything like it, and I don't think there's ever been anything like it since. Now, if the United States of America has the good fortune to last as many years as Rome did, perhaps that will be different in about 1,000 years. But at least in terms of our history today, even as great as our country is, I don't think it has the power over the world and the influence over the world that the city-state of Rome had throughout its history. It really depends on how you define starting and ending, but most historians will agree that the city of Rome itself had influence for anywhere from 1500 to 1800 years. And its influence, in a sense, followed three different stages. Obviously, at first, as it gained power and ruled the world, its influence was mostly in its system of government. In fact, the system of government that we have today is very much influenced by the Roman style of government. In fact, the most important body of their government was the Senate, and we also have a Senate. But eventually, their power in the government sphere waned, and then they became a world leader in the subject of religion. By religion, I mean the Catholic Church, which during the early, the early centuries up through the Middle Ages was the power in the world. In the world, as they knew it at the time, Europe, Middle East, Northern Africa, at some point the power of the city of Rome waned, and quite frankly, the Catholic Church took over. And then eventually even the influence of the Catholic Church ended, and by that time we're up into the Renaissance, and the power of the city of Rome is basically in the arts, and that lasts throughout the Renaissance. Now, the city of Rome was established as a trading post on the crossroads of a river and land route. And as the students know, it grew up around seven hills, mostly because of the severe flooding problem caused by the river that ran near it. Now, the Empire of Rome was really not established until a couple hundred years before Christ's birth, when the city of Rome, in a series of battles with other Roman city-states, eventually won and took over. That can be defined as a starting point of the Roman Empire. The high point, if you will, of the Roman Empire, if only because it established some supremacy, was when they defeated the Greek Empire in about 160 BC. Unfortunately, as we all know, and as so often happens with other empires, their strength, their power, their wealth eventually overtook them, and this led to a very severe moral decline in the Roman Empire. And we've discussed in other sermons before some of the problems that the Roman Empire had. They were so wealthy. The wealth of the Roman Empire, it would just be unfathomable. Leisure became their most important activity during the day. As we also know, homosexuality became a way of life, not only for its leaders, but also for its common citizens. Because of their interest in leisure more than work, eventually the Roman Empire had trouble keeping and putting together their army. And eventually they became completely reliable on slave labor, which basically meant that they were almost always close to rebellion of some sort. All of these factors eventually led to many, many class wars. And in fact, Julius Caesar, probably the most famous of all the emperors, came to power in about 46 BC as a result of a series of those wars. Now, Caesar, to some extent, was important because he was probably, for all his infamy, he was probably the first Roman emperor that really made any leeway towards reform. And by that I mean, up to this day, the Romans were led by the elite in the Senate. As we all know, there were certain rules about who could vote, who could own land, and of course you couldn't vote unless you had land. So the power became controlled by a very rich and elite group. Quite frankly, Julius Caesar was trying to change that. And while, of course, there are many factors which led to his eventual assassination, most experts believe that it is his attempts to reform the Roman way of life that eventually led to his assassination. Of course, after his death, there was another series of lengthy civil wars, and there really was no clear-cut leader until Augustus, who what had been Julius Caesar's heir apparent, took power about 14 years later, in 30 BC. Compared to other Roman emperors at the time, he enjoyed a very long reign. I believe he ruled until about 14 AD. In fact, the time frame of his reign is known as the Golden Age of the Roman Empire. Now, Tiberius eventually takes over as emperor, and he is, in fact, the emperor at the time of Christ's death. That's how the Roman Empire got to where we're at, close to the time of Jesus' death. As we also know, Pontius Pilate is the governor of Judea at the time, appointed by and serving at the pleasure of the Roman emperor. Now let's discuss the Jews. How did they get to be where they're at this time? Well, it'd be very difficult to summarize the history of the Jewish nation in what little time I have. So I'm going to start at about 63 BC. 63 BC is when Roman rule over the Jews started, and that's when Judea became part of the Roman province of Syria. Now at this time, Judea would be at the eastern end of the Roman Empire. Probably the first and most important Jewish leader during that time frame is Herod the Great. Now, this is not the same Herod we read about in the Bible beheading John the Baptist and eventually playing a part in Jesus' death. But Herod the Great was named by the Romans as the king of the Jews in 37 BC. Now this is important because, again, the Jewish nation is under the control of the Roman Empire at this time, and anyone who serves in any capacity, quite frankly, whether it's the Jewish king, the priests, they will all serve because of the control that the Romans have at their pleasure. Now, Herod himself, as we all know, was despised and hated by the Jewish citizens. Most of all, and firstly, the reason is he simply was not a Jew. He was placed in power by the Romans, and he was never trusted by the Jewish citizens. He was a cruel man. He was not afraid to use punishment. And also, very importantly, not only was he hated by common Jewish citizens, but he was also hated by the priests, not only because of his role and his cruelty, but because, quite frankly, until that time, they enjoyed the power that there was in Judea. And when he took over and ruled with the approval and at the pleasure of the Romans, it stripped the priests of very much of their power. Now, at his death, which, if I recall correctly, was shortly after the birth of Christ, his will divided the kingdom of Judea between his three sons. And this division remained in place for many years. And it's important to note at this time that his son Herod Antipas, who is the Herod that we read about in the Bible, took over the reign of Galilee. Now, another important aspect of the Jewish nation that we need to discuss at this time is the Sanhedrin. Now, the Sanhedrin had its original beginnings as advisors to Moses. I'd just like to read a short passage from Numbers, chapter 11, starting at verse 11. It says, "And Moses said unto the Lord, Wherefore hast thou afflicted thy servant? And wherefore have I not found favor in thy sight, that thou layest the burden of all this people upon me? Have I conceived all this people? Have I begotten them, that thou shouldest say unto me, Carry them in thy bosom, as a nursing father beareth the sucking child, unto the land which thou swearest unto their fathers? When should I have flesh to give unto all this people? For they weep unto me, saying, Give us flesh, that we may eat. I am not able to bear all this people alone, because it is too heavy for me. And if thou deal thus with me, kill me, I pray thee, out of hand, if I have found favor in thy sight, and let me not see my wretchedness. And the Lord said unto Moses, Gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom thou knowest to be the elders of the people, and officers over them, and bring them unto the tabernacle of the congregation, that they may stand there with thee. And I will come down and talk with thee there, and I will take of the Spirit which is upon thee, and will put it upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with thee, that they bear it not thyself alone." So what's happening here is Moses is basically saying to the Lord, "I need help." And the Lord responds by, in a sense, setting up this council, if you will, of elders who are to assist Moses in ruling and making decisions. That is the beginning of what, by the time of Jesus, is known as the Sanhedrin. And even at the time of Jesus' death, it consists of 71 members. Originally, there were 70 plus Moses. Now, it was led by the high priest, and to a certain extent, the logic there was the high priest basically took over the role that Moses had in the original conference. Now, the Sanhedrin claimed supreme power over the Jews, and in fact, Orthodox Jews had no power, had no problem subjecting themselves to the Sanhedrin. But the problem was, the Roman authorities and Herod also only recognized their authority, the authority of the Sanhedrin, that is, over the Jews in Judea and under Jewish law. As an example of what this really meant, while the Sanhedrin had complete authority in passing sentences over Jewish citizens for religious offenses, they could not execute the sentence without confirmation by civil authority. In other words, you have to ask the Romans if it's okay to do something. Now, in the Sanhedrin at the time, there are many different groups. Just like in any assembly, you have certain political parties. And the Sanhedrin was no different. There were two strong factions in the Sanhedrin at that time, and I've taken liberty of following the lead of a couple writers and broken them down into two groups, conservatives and liberals. Now, the conservatives were led by the Sadducees and the higher priests. The Sadducees were very nationalistic. By that I mean they had very strong beliefs about preserving the Jewish way of life. They were not very quick to appease or agree with the Roman leaders. They were very orthodox in their religion and followed a strong enforcement of the Torah, which was the written law of the Jews, which in the Bible is recorded in Deuteronomy and Numbers, I believe. Now, the liberals were made up of the Pharisees and the scribes, or the scholars. They were different from the Sadducees in that they were a little bit more reconciled to Roman rule. In other words, they were much more quicker to appease the Roman rulers. And they, while they certainly followed the Torah, they were not afraid to promulgate or enact, if you will, some other provisions of their own to expand upon the Torah. Now, let's discuss Jesus. Now, just like with the Jews, you don't want to sit here all night to discuss the life history of Jesus. So I'm not going to do that. It would be impossible to summarize his life. But I think it is also important for the historical perspective to take a look at the short-term events that led to him arriving in Jerusalem. Now, keep in mind that Jesus has spent his life trying to teach the Jews of his role, that he's the Son of God, the King of Heaven, and can offer them salvation. He's going around the countryside teaching, preaching, and performing miracles. Now, just days before he eventually makes his way to Jerusalem and ultimately his death, Caiaphas, who at that time is the high priest of the Sanhedrin, calls a meeting of the Sanhedrin. Caiaphas at this meeting expresses great concern over the popularity of Jesus at that time. If you will, take a look with me at John chapter 11, starting at verse 47. This discusses, in fact, that meeting. And it says, "Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council, and said, 'What do we? For this man doeth many miracles. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation.' And one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, 'Ye know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. And this spake he not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation. And not for that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad. Then from that day forth they took counsel together for to put him to death." So as you can see, Jesus isn't even in Jerusalem yet. In fact, it's about a week away. And the Sanhedrin has gathered and determined already that they're going to put him to death. And it's important also to note that this meeting was called and this decision was made at the behest of Caiaphas, who we will find out will play a very important role in Jesus' ultimate death. Now, Jesus enters Jerusalem, like I said, about 6 to 7 days before his ultimate death. Now again, keep in mind, even those people around the countryside who have not seen or heard Jesus are hearing of him. Now this is the time of the Passover feast, so the countryside is migrating, if you will, to Jerusalem for the Passover feast, and a lot of people are going to see Jesus. And some writers indicate that the purpose of this trip to Jerusalem for Jesus is to make his final appeal to the Jewish citizens. Now, upon his entrance to the city of Jerusalem, he garners very much attention. Take a look at John chapter 12, verse 13. He is hailed by the citizens as the King of Israel. In Luke 19:38, the disciples hail him by shouting, "Blessed be the King that cometh in the name of the Lord." Excuse me. Now, this highlights a very big problem that Jesus has at the time, because as I've indicated, his mission has been to teach the gospel, to proclaim himself as the Son of God, and to offer these people heaven. But the people still don't get it, because they still see Jesus as someone who is a political savior, someone who's going to lead them out of Roman bondage. And it's this belief, unfortunately, which ultimately leads to his death. Now, a day or two after he enters Jerusalem, he enters the temple. And we all know the story about what happened in the temple. As I've indicated, the Passover is at hand. The city of Jerusalem is somewhat overcrowded, and so is the temple. And in the temple, the courtyard is filled with the noise of vendors selling doves and other sacrificial animals. The money changers are in there. Money changers are probably an old version of our bankers. Their job at the time was to offer local currency and trade for Roman coins. And there were other various merchants in the temple. Well, of course, as we all know, Jesus is shocked by the noise and the commercialism and overturns the table, scatters the coins. And, of course, this also draws the attention of both the Roman and the Jewish leaders. Because for most of Christ's life, they paid him very little attention. But now they see how much power and, if you will, control, though that's, I don't think that's a fair phrase, he has over the masses. And, of course, they fear for their power. The Romans don't want revolt. As we've indicated, some of the Jewish leaders fear revolt, which will take away some of their freedoms from the Romans. So all these forces, the history of the Romans, the history of the Jews, and now Jesus being in Jerusalem at this time, all converge at one night and ultimately lead to the death of Christ. So now let's discuss what we're really here for, I guess, is the trial of Jesus. Now, as we all know, the trial really had many phases. I don't think the trial itself is all there is. I think there are other issues to look at. Not only do you have to look at the trial itself, but you have to look at the arrest of Jesus and obviously his execution. Obviously, the execution is a whole series of sermons all by itself, so I'm not going to try to address that. But I will discuss both the arrest and trial. Now, again, to put us in place, the night of his arrest, Jesus and his disciples have had their evening meal, which we now refer to as the Last Supper, and they leave the city of Jerusalem to go out to the Mount of Olives. Jesus goes out to the Garden of Gethsemane to pray, and upon his return to the group of his disciples, he's approached and ultimately arrested by a mob, band, group, whatever have you. I think each gospel refers to it differently. Now, this group, significantly, is made up of several different people. Well, obviously, any group's made up of several different people, several different types of people. This group is made up of some Roman soldiers, some temple guards, who obviously are under control of the religious leaders, and a generally described mob, or multitude, if you will. Now, it's significant about the temple guards being there, because obviously if this is Passover feast time, and we're talking about the city of Jerusalem, there's a lot going on inside the city of Jerusalem that these temple guards need to be paying attention to. But someone in power, and of course there are a lot of writers who have different opinions, think that they need to be out there arresting Jesus, as if the Roman guards can't do it well enough on their own. So I think this is a clear sign of premeditation on the part of the chief priest and the Sanhedrin. Now, as far as the arrest itself, almost from the beginning, things go wrong, if you will, with the arrest to make it remarkable. First of all, none of the scriptures, and even modern writers, do not try to dispute the fact that there was no arrest warrant. Now, my research indicates that a warrant does need to be presented with a Jewish arrest. It was unclear to me in my research whether or not that applied in this scenario to certain Roman arrests. So if we assume for a minute that, as we all know, there was two stages to the trial, and the first stage was a form of a Jewish trial, obviously if he's going to face charges in front of a Jewish tribunal, there has to be a warrant. But there was no warrant that night. And to put this in context, even in our American system today, a police officer can only arrest if he has a warrant telling him to arrest a person, or he has what's called reasonable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. Now, the phrase reasonable cause is hard to define, but if we can put it in practice, what we're really talking about is if a policeman shows up at a crime scene, obviously too late to witness himself, and a witness says, I saw it, and he's the person who did it, the police officer now has probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, and that person has, in fact, committed the crime. So he can arrest that person, even without a warrant. The Jewish system, and as we'll find out as we go through these problems with the arrest, availed or provided many more personal freedoms to the Jewish citizen than even the United States citizen system does today. Because in this case, it's clear to me that there should have been an arrest warrant to arrest Jesus, and there simply was not. At least there is not one mentioned in the scriptures. The other problem with this arrest is the fact that, and this is a very unique law, but it was in the Jewish system. Jewish law forbade all criminal proceedings, including trials and arrests, between the hours of sunset and sunrise. In other words, once it got dark, there were no arrest powers. You could not arrest any Jewish citizen, Jewish person, during the nighttime hours. Now, since Jesus was clearly arrested for a violation of a religious law, as we'll find out when we get to the Jewish phase of the trial, he should not have been arrested at the time he was. And while there's some dispute about the timing of Jesus' trials themselves, there's no doubt and no dispute that the arrest itself did occur after dark in clear violation of Jewish law. Another very strong personal right or freedom provided in Jewish law was it forbade the testimony of a co-accomplice either as a witness or as an accuser. If you recall the scene when Jesus was arrested, as we all know, Judas had been bribed to identify Jesus with a kiss. Well, since Jewish law forbade the testimony of a co-accomplice, either as a witness at trial or as an original accuser, it's clear that if Jesus is really guilty of blasphemy, which was the ultimate accusation, then clearly Judas and the rest of all the disciples were just as guilty, and they could not be used as a witness or as an accuser for those crimes. Now, those are the circumstances surrounding the arrest of Jesus. Now, let's look at the trial itself. Unfortunately, like so many other things that happen in the Bible, we want to ask questions. We don't always have all the answers. And the problem in interpreting Jesus' trial in front of the Jewish nation is the fact that there's very little information provided. In fact, if you take a look at your Bibles, you can read about the trial in front of Caiaphas at Matthew 26, verses 57 through 66, and in Mark chapter 14, verses 53 to 64. So about 10 verses in each one of those two Gospels tell us about the trial of Jesus. Now, in the Jewish system at the time, there were really three parts the Jewish legal system. The lowest rung of the ladder, if you will, was a three-judge panel. They did not have a jury trial system in at that time. And the three-judge panel would be the lowest level. In our system, it would be the local county courts. Above that, which would be compared to our local or state appeals courts, would be a 21-judge panel referred to as the Junior Sanhedrin. And then, of course, above that is the 71-person or judge panel that we've already discussed, the Sanhedrin itself. Now, after Jesus is arrested, he's taken by this mob directly to the house of Caiaphas, the high priest of the Sanhedrin. Now here, if you read modern writers, there is some disagreement on whether the whole of the Sanhedrin played a role in the trial of Jesus in the Jewish phase of the trial. There's much difference, and the general belief among modern writers seems to be that found in John chapter 18, which indicates that Jesus was examined by Annas and then Caiaphas, and that the Sanhedrin wasn't present. What bothers me with that interpretation is if you review Matthew and Mark, specifically Matthew 26, verse 59, and Mark 14, verse 53, those two Gospels clearly indicate the presence of the priests, the scribes, in other words, the Sanhedrin. So there are different versions of what happened here, as is common to some extent in the Bible, and it's left to us to interpret the real meaning. However, my research seems to indicate that under either scenario, a grave injustice was done to Jesus. First of all, if the trial was conducted just in front of just the high priest alone, that's a clear violation of the Jewish system, because I've just outlined it. Nowhere in the system did they contemplate a trial by one judge. They started with the three-judge system to ensure fairness. There's no jury. There's no... with one judge, that is, if there's no jury, there's no differing of opinion, there's no different outlooks on life, and the purpose with the three-judge panel was to make assure fairness. Here, if Jesus was, if Jesus' first phase of the trial was conducted in front of Caiaphas, that's a clear violation of a basic tenet of Jewish law. On the other hand, as I've indicated, the mob was taken directly to the house of Caiaphas, the high priest of the Sanhedrin. There's another provision in Jewish law that indicates the Sanhedrin is to meet for trial for these kind of purposes only on the temple grounds. For instance, if you read Deuteronomy 17, verses 8 through 10, let's take a quick look at that. It says, if there arise a matter too hard for thee in judgment, between blood and blood, between plea and plea, and between stroke and stroke, being matters of controversy within thy gates, then shalt thou arise and get thee up into the place which the Lord thy God shall choose. And thou shalt come unto the priests, the Levites, and unto the judge that shall be in those days, and inquire, and they shall show thee the sentence of judgment. And thou shalt do accordingly to the sentence which they of that place which the Lord shall choose, shall shew thee, and thou shalt observe to do according to all that they inform thee. In other words, for the Sanhedrin to have any power, to meet, to have any jurisdiction, they're to be in the temple. As we've indicated, this trial occurred at the high priest's home. Another important provision that seems to have completely gotten lost in this whole process was the fact that the Sanhedrin itself could not originate charges. The original purpose, as we have discussed, of the Sanhedrin was to resolve charges brought by others and to act, if we will, as an appeals court for the lower courts. It could not make allegations or bring charges of its own. For example, in the United States system today, the prosecutor's function is to investigate and determine whether or not any formal charges need to be brought before a jury, before the judge. The judge and the jury then are charged with listening to the facts, deciding guilt or innocence, and then ultimately sentencing. In the case of Jesus, the Sanhedrin, in a sense, took on both roles. But we already know why they did. They've already decided that Jesus has to die. They're not going to leave it in anybody else's hands to make that determination. Some other provisions of Jewish law that were obviously ignored that evening. A very important provision is that no criminal trial could be conducted on festival days or on the eve of a festival. Well, we've already determined that this is, in fact, the eve of the Passover. But like so many other provisions of the Jewish law, this one was completely ignored as well. And let's also look at the charge that Jesus faced. Jesus was accused of blasphemy. Under Jewish law, there were really two different categories of blasphemy, if you will. In Leviticus chapter 24, verse 15 and 16, it says, "Whosoever curseth his God shall bear his sin, and he that blasphemeth the name of the Lord, he shall surely be put to death, and all the congregation shall certainly stone him, as well as the stranger, as he that is born in the land, when he blasphemeth the name of the Lord, shall be put to death." Now, the rules of the Sanhedrin themselves address this by basically saying the law was laid down to be that a blasphemer is not liable to the death penalty unless he has pronounced the name of God, that is. Cursing or blaspheming God without pronouncing the name by using any of God's many descriptive or circumscriptive epithets is punishable by flogging only. Now, as we see, Jesus was ultimately sentenced to death. We have to infer from that, then, that Jesus was accused of voicing the name of God, which, of course, he did not do. Some other minor provisions, I hate to refer them to as minor, but they are only addressed briefly in the historical books. This trial was conducted before the morning sacrifices, which is another Jewish violation, and the whole event, including Christ's death, took less than 24 hours. In fact, literally, including his death, took significantly less than 24 hours. Now, it was a strict rule in Jewish law that civil cases were to be tried during the day and could be completed at night. So if this was a civil trial, two parties having a dispute between themselves, this trial could go on all the time. But there was a different rule for criminal cases. Criminal cases were tried during the day and had to be completed during the daytime. If the accused was acquitted, the criminal trial could be completed on the same day, but if he wasn't acquitted, it had to be adjourned the next day when judgment would be pronounced. Therefore, no criminal trials could be held in a 24-hour, no criminal trials and execution could be conducted in a 24-hour period, and obviously neither could a trial commence on the Sabbath or a Sabbath Eve, because if you carry it over into the next day, of course, then you're into the Sabbath. Now, one other thing, there was another very peculiar provision in Jewish law, and let me just say, before I go into it, that it is another area that a lot of the modern scholars have a difference of opinion on, because it's very peculiar indeed, but it's not universally established. But some historians believe that there was a provision in the law that went something like this. If in front of the Sanhedrin, the accused was found guilty by all 71 members, or all members present, then it was let free. But logic being, if the poor soul could not convince one person of his innocence, then that was an indication that a valid defense was not presented or that it was otherwise not a fair trial. Now, again, if we assume for a minute that was, in fact, a provision of Jewish law, then clearly Jesus should have walked free from the at the end of the trial in front of Caiaphas. Because, as the gospel writers indicate, it was a clear unanimous verdict of the council present. If you take a look at Mark 14, verse 64, the chief priest says, "Ye have heard the blasphemy, what think ye?" And they all condemned him to death. In other words, all present found Jesus guilty and condemned him to death. So if this provision is, in fact, in the Jewish law at the time, Jesus should have walked free that morning. Now, as the trial of Jesus unfolded, it became obvious that the witnesses were not doing a very good job. They were not telling the same story, and they simply could not get their story straight. Now, in desperation, Caiaphas broke another basic rule of Jewish law by simply asking a question to Jesus directly. If you take a look with me at Mark 14, starting at verse 55. "And the chief priests and all the council sought for witness against Jesus to put him to death, and found none. For many bare false witness against him, but their witnesses agreed not together. And there arose certain and bare false witnesses against him, saying, We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But neither so did their witnesses agree together. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But he held his peace and answered nothing. Again the high priest asked him and said unto him, Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? So Caiaphas is trying to do here, but Jesus does not let him get away with, is to get Jesus to incriminate himself. Basic tenet of Jewish law, in fact, it even provides, it's another area that provides even more protection for the Jewish people than we have in this country, is a provision that basically says a Jewish person cannot be compelled to make a statement or testify against himself. In fact, if he makes a confession, it may not be used against him at trial. Now, that's very much unlike our system, where we do have some protection against self-incrimination. But if an American citizen does make a confession, subject to certain protections, it is admissible at a trial. Excuse me. Well, as we've already determined, Jesus was found guilty by the Sanhedrin, sentenced to death. As we've also already determined, there has to be two phases to this trial. The Jews do not have authority to sentence him to death without review by the Roman tribunal. Well, in furtherance of that, the Jews take Jesus before. Now, in the court of Pilate, they accuse Jesus of trying to incite rebellion by claiming to be the king of the Jews. Now, this is remarkable in that if you recall when Jesus first entered Jerusalem, that's exactly what the mob wanted him to do. But obviously, enough significant events have happened in 1 week that now they find that's the only way to get the execution followed through, and that is to accuse him of citing rebellion. Now, as part of Pilate's role in the trial of Jesus, again, this is another area where if you read modern writers, they have some difference of opinion as to what was going on. If you take a look at John chapter 18, John 18, the story of the trial of Jesus as outlined in there clearly seems to indicate that Pilate honestly feels, based upon the evidence, that Jesus is innocent and is going back and forth trying to talk the Jews out of further action. It's important to note, for your benefit, there are other writers who take the position that Pilate was really trying to find some charges that he could justify, because based upon the evidence presented to him that day, Jesus was guilty of nothing, but yet, just like the Jewish leaders, he wanted to get rid of Jesus too. But in any event, when all was said and done, Pilate could find no real reason to punish him, and he found him innocent. Take a look at John 18, verse 38. Now, the Gospel of Luke reveals something that the other three Gospels do not address, and that is the transfer of Jesus physically, if you will, over to Herod. During the trial in front of Pilate, Pilate discovers that he is from Galilee, and knowing that Herod is in town for the festival himself, he, in a sense, tries to shove this off on Herod and let it become Herod's problem. Well, Jesus goes before Herod, and Herod does the same thing that Pilate did. He examines him and finds no fault. So he sends him back to Pilate. Well, Pilate tries one more time to convince the Jews that he's done nothing wrong, but they will not give up, requesting instead that Barabbas be released. Sadly, and in a feeble attempt, I think, to absolve himself of blame, Pilate agrees and eventually condemns Jesus to death. Thus ends probably the most famous trial in history, if you will. Now, who's really to blame for Jesus' death? Well, not surprisingly, modern-day historians, depending upon which side they're on, point the finger in all sorts of directions. In fact, my best authority in researching for this sermon was a book by a member of the Israeli Supreme Court called The Trial of Jesus. And even though he was a very good source for explaining some of the Jewish laws to me, the bottom line of his book was that the role of the Jews was actually that of trying to save Jesus. The purpose of the trial before Caiaphas, before he went in front of Pilate, was really to coach Jesus for the trial in front of Pilate the next day. And of course, in my research, there were all kinds of other different theories as well, but that one was remarkable to me. The truth is, there's plenty of blame to go around. I think the Romans and the Jews themselves, in their sheer search and lust and jockeying for power, certainly went out of their way to carry on this great injustice. Also, Jesus' own disciples. There's no getting around the fact that they certainly forsook him and were not there to aid him in any way either. And then, of course, this multitude of people that Jesus had so swayed over his life, when push came to shove in the final days of his life, they weren't there for him either. The fact is, Jesus ended up exactly as he prophesied he would, and that is, all alone. That's the trial of Jesus. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to come up here and speak to you today. It's a lot funner than I thought it was going to be. The fact is, we all agree that Jesus was judged wrongly and unfairly. But you know, in preparing for heaven, we're assured a much fairer trial than Jesus himself got. We're assured of trial, in a sense, in front of God himself. And just like the Jewish law, our law, in a sense, has a few simple rules we need to follow to get to heaven. We need to believe, we need to repent, and we need to be baptized. If you do all those things, you're capable of being found worthy of a home in heaven with God and Jesus Christ. If there's anyone here today who desires the assistance of this congregation in entering into that relationship with God through repentance and baptism, or if there's anyone here who desires prayers of this congregation, we urge you to come forward this evening as we sing this invitation song.